one member today, Justin Wilson, but we've replaced him with a much more foreign, more attractive version. Andrew Thrift is going to be joining us. I'm going to go ahead and announce him. He's right there. He's the Kiwi down at the bottom. Go ahead and say hi, Andrew.
Hey, guys.
All the way from New Zealand. And then we've got your normal bonehead over on the left side of my screen. We got Andrew Cox. Of course, there was no doubt. I don't know why he waited to react. He knew who I was talking about. And then we've got J.J. Boyd with us as well, the master of everything wireless. So this episode, episode 8, I believe, we're just going to first grill Andrew on who he is, what he does, and what we can milk him for, what information, and we'll ditch him and get rid of him, like a used Kleenex. And then we'll talk about some hardware. So, Andrew, who are you? What do you do?
I'm a consultant based in New Zealand, obviously. I'm one of the smaller cities in New Zealand. Got quite a bit of a background with Microtech, probably been using it since 2.8. And I also specialize in doing MPLS and things like that with it. So we've got some quite big networks running Microtech routers and Juniper and various other vendors, but mainly Microtech. Running MPLS and VPLS and that sort of thing, and we've got a few small wireless networks around the place that we pretty much just use to keep our knowledge levels up.
Oh, cool. Yeah. And I know you talked about multiple vendors. I know you've got some intimate knowledge of Fortinet, is that right?
Yeah, we do quite a lot with Fortinet as well.
Okay, so that's going to be an avenue not a lot of us, I think, have worked with some of those appliances. And I know I've done a bit on the Cisco MPLS side, but I haven't really gotten heavy into the Microtech MPLS side, so I think I definitely want to hear you kind of talk about your experiences, good and bad, but obviously both, because we're impartial here. I mean, what can you tell us about it? Like, how'd you get started in it? I mean, what are your kind of thoughts on it?
With the MPLS, do you mean, or do you mean generally with Microtech?
Both. Why not? How'd you get started in MPLS? Well, how long have you been using it?
Well, I'd been using Microtech for quite a while. We used it to do a couple of point-to-point links back many years ago, and they worked, and I kind of forgot about it for a long time until one day we needed to do another point-to-point link and bought some more Microtech router boards. I think they were the RV600s at that stage, and set up another wireless link, and it worked great as well. And then I noticed they had all this new functionality, BGP and dynamic routing and that, and we just started using it a lot more, mainly because we had issues with our Junipers and traffic shaping. Basically, we couldn't do everything with one box, which we like to do a lot of in New Zealand, so ended up using the Microtechs. And it's gone from there. So from that, we started doing MPLS and just trying to, I guess, shove more down a single pipe, and we continued on with that, and we've got some pretty good deployments now running VPLS back carrying PPPoE and also running MPLS carrying multiple, I guess, BGP sessions or VRFs, if you like to call them that, just to separate networks and keep them going over the same path. I guess the experiences have been generally pretty good, but it's depends on how mature the software is and how many other people are using it seems with the Microtech stuff.
So do you feel like the MPLS is kind of one of the underutilized technologies, so it's maybe not tested enough and not enough bugs are reported and maybe just not enough energy put into it?
I definitely think that's the case. I mean, I know most of the other people who I'd say using MPLS on Microtech relatively seriously, and we'll encounter various different bugs and we'll try and push them through Microtech and get varying different levels of response depending on if they want to acknowledge it exists or not, or if they're busy working on IPv6 or wireless features that week. But yeah, it's a pretty good platform, I think.
Okay. So do you feel like the MPLS is pretty stable, maybe on a smaller scale, but as you grow and expand, it kind of gets a little wonky? Or I mean,
VPLS is definitely stable. I'd recommend that to anybody to use, and you're not going to have very many issues with it. It's when you start trying to do VRFs and layer 3 VPNs and that sort of thing, you're definitely going to experience some issues.
Okay, just so VPLS is good. The majority of people I know using MPLS are using them kind of on the point-to-point leak sort of side, and So they're doing MPLS, BPLS just on that one point-to-point link. And
Sticking around the limitations of 802.11n or?
Yeah, just a sidestep WDS with InStream. People have been having kind of some problems doing that, so they found the VPLS seems to work pretty well, and I've heard it's stable. I mean, I've done it on a couple links. I haven't had any problems with it.
Yeah, we've got some gigabit links between, I guess, a production and DR sites, just using the x86 version of MikroTik that have been up in excess of 500 days. So it seems to be pretty stable on the VPLS side, at least.
I would definitely agree with you on that. That's good. I know the core of the majority of our networks is Cisco, so doing the Cisco MPLS, you know, really makes sense to just kind of stick with. I mean, forklift upgrades hard to do these days, you know, just replace all your hardware. But it's super stable, and I know it's a relatively new technology, the MikroTik. So myself, along with some other people, have been kind of just sitting and waiting for everybody else to use it. And I think that's probably part of the problem that's making it take so long, is that more people adopt it, then they'll hear more about it, and definitely get more feedback about it. So I guess I feel responsible, but not responsible enough. So I feel like it's in capable hands there. So
is MikroTik's implementation of MPLS, is it their own code, or are they taking another open source package? At one point in time, I seen where they had the packages listed on their website somewhere that were incorporated in RouterOS, but that's since, I don't know, I can't find it now.
That's still available from what I've seen. It's listed in the terms and conditions somewhere. There's a listing of open source packages and the fact that you can write away to get some of the source code.
I think part of the GPL license is if you use open source code, you have to make that available or something. I think if you make modifications of your own, you don't have to release that specific part, but I think something like that.
MikroTik's MPLS is definitely their own implementation. The feature set of it is far exceeds any of the open source implementations, and they had an MPLS implementation, I believe, before there were even any open source MPLS packages in existence. So they seem to have done it from scratch.
That's pretty cool to think that they had that much vision to actually, you know, go out there and chase it. I didn't even really think of it.
Just to dive in and step back for a second, considering we have people from all different stages of running WISPs and ISPs listening in on this, would you like to go over, Andrew, and just in brief explain what MPLS does for an ISP and what sort of features most people will benefit from in MPLS?
Okay, I'll explain that a bit. What MPLS is it's, I guess, halfway between a layer 2 and a 3 protocol. So you've got the benefits of layer 3 in that it makes use of the existing routing protocols you've got on your network, so your OSPF and your BGP and things like that. So you still have a routed path across your network. So it gets away from having bridges everywhere. You can have a routed network with a standard backbone, and all the, you can run /30s between your links over your wireless links and your bridge links even. You can run a /30 or /29 or a nice small subnet over that. And your routers on your path become label switch routers. So when a packet goes across the path for the first time, it will look up in your normal routing table, hey, is this the way to go? Next time, it will have a label attached to it because it now knows the path, and the router does not need to look up in the routing table which way it has to go. It just switches it like a hardware switch that you've got, like your little D-Link switch sitting on your desk. It uses labels rather than having to look at the routing table every single time. So it's much more efficient, and you can do a lot more with it. So why would a wireless ISP use it? I guess if they're looking for slightly higher throughput with less CPU utilization on their MikroTik devices, MPLS will give them that. It also allows you to hide a lot of your network from your users, because MPLS hides that. They can't see the labels. They can't see the path that it's actually traversed. They just see where it came into the network and where it came out. And you can also run VPLS over the top if you want to backhaul particularly PPPoE, or if you want to link two of your customers' sites together and transport data between them at a layer two. So you could sell a customer a VPN service where they get an Ethernet port and any VLAN they throw in there comes out at the other end, and what's in between is completely transparent to them. So it's like a VPN service, but layer two. Does that make sense, guys?
Yeah. Would you see this really used more in, say, an ISP that has kind of a metro area as opposed to sort of a WISP? Because most of the WISP we see are people doing kind of home user connectivity. And so, I mean, how would you really envision it?
It's something that you'd use in a larger ISP. So if you've got, say, under 100 customers, there's probably absolutely no point in using MPLS and VPLS. But for larger wireless ISPs where you've got a whole bunch of towers, there would be some advantages of using it for you. And if you're wanting to offer, I guess, premium services, so I guess wide area networks that are managed wide area networks or layer two VPNs between your sites, it's definitely something you'd want to be using.
Yeah, cool. Because I've had a lot of people shoot me emails saying, hey, I've got, you know, this customer that's over on site A and the one in another city in site B, and they want to do connectivity between the two. You know, they want it to be kind of a switch connectivity, so it comes into a switch port, pops out a switch port, and I definitely want to do MPLS. And they're saying they've got this one internet connection, this other internet connection, and people seem to not understand that you have to own the infrastructure from point A to point B, and you have to put the MPLS connectivity all the way in between. If it's two internet connections, you don't use MPLS. You have to own the entire
network.
Exactly.
It creates a label switched path, so you need to have control over every device in that path.
Right. All the way through. That's a lot of people miss that step somehow. I don't know. Just they see the benefits of, oh, it can do this thing. Well, I definitely want to do that, but they don't understand. You have to actually own every hop in the chain in between the two sites.
Then on top of that, there comes other features like the traffic engineering and determining which paths traffic goes via when certain services are down. So if you need to provision VoIP circuits and critical business circuits to go over specific paths, you can do that. And when one falls over, well, this is now going out here, this is going out here. Everything continues running as intended. So there's a lot of good features in there as well.
I don't know, but nowadays with link speeds, everything's getting so fast. It's almost like you don't have to traffic engineer. Just put out a new piece of equipment that can do double the bandwidth, and we're good.
Look, you're talking about America and the rest of the world here, whereas we're talking about Australia. And
that's
New
right.
Zealand.
You pay an extra 60 cents, and they supersize it. Your drink gets 8 feet tall, and your bucket of fries you have to carry in a wheelbarrow. That's the way it works around here.
I was going to say MPLS is one of those technologies where until you've actually used it, you'll never fully understand it. You've actually got to have a play with it. So if it's something you're looking at deploying, run it up on a couple of virtual machines or buy a couple of RB750 GLs or something similar and just have a play with it.
Yeah. I think to what you were saying, the MPLS is great for kind of business customers when you're doing interconnectivity or major sites, and It really seems to scale well when you're doing a lot of that stuff. If you've got even a moderately sized network and you've only got one customer that wants to do one connectivity, you know, point A to one point B, and that's it, I don't know that reengineering your entire infrastructure for MPLS really makes sense for that. Again, this would be a situation for just a tunnel, maybe an EOIP, even if you need the. You really got to put a lot of thought into the MPLS. You got to, like Andrew, you got to be playing with the big boys if you're really going to roll this stuff out. And definitely having a good game plan, I think, is critical as well. You can't just jump right in.
Yeah, you can't just decide that you're going to switch all your towers to having MPLS running and you're going to do it overnight. You've actually got to have a think about it and play with it before you do that. Otherwise, you will end in a world of pain.
Yeah. And you are adding several layers of complexity. So you've got your dynamic routing protocol running, and then on top of that, you're adding MPLS. And then if you want VPLS, you add that on top of the MPLS. So you've got
that's right.
three pieces of technology that all have to work in concert for that to happen just right. So it can get fairly complicated.
And then
you've got to worry about, you know, say you upgrade to a new version and there's a bug introduced in any one of those layers, then things can get hairy real quick. And I'm sure that's why Andrew's hair is sticking straight up from him. It's from him just like, just pulling it out.
No, I'm surprised I've got any left, actually. you've got to really test the versions before you deploy them if you're using MPLS. I mean, there have been some versions that have completely broken functionality. So people who are running the MPLS networks on version 4, if they upgraded to version any of the earlier version 5 releases, they would have found that none of their tunnels worked anymore. Oh, and the only way to do it was basically to blank the config off the box and start again. And that's not the only time that's happened. So it's something that you've really got to test everything with.
Wow. That's cool. That's cool. Yeah,
I imagine
we definitely have the heaviest use of anybody I know. So I have a feeling you coming on here and admitting the fact that you have this much MPLS knowledge, I think, makes you a target. So you're a very brave man, I think, one. And the fact that I'm going to tell everybody what your forum username is probably another blight for you. But
I'm the guy that'll be accused of being negative.
No, for sure, for sure. I think it's a fantastic technology. I think everybody should at least have a look at it, lab it up, play with it, if nothing else. What do you guys think? Yeah.
There's always the issue where when you're rolling out something like that as well, it's not just you who's doing the rollout or your team that's doing the rollout. It's the people that have to support it need to understand how it works as well, because you've all of a sudden got a point-to-point tunnel, essentially, and an issue could be with any one of the hops along the way, but as far as the end user's concerned, that's transparent. So having people that understand how it all works and being able to accurately troubleshoot that is also a big part of any deployment.
Yeah,
making sure you have protocols in place.
When a user does a trace route, it looks like one hop to them. Then it's there. So they have no visibility about the magic that happens behind, so it's all on you. That can be terrifying. that's a very good point. I mean, you can't have this complicated empire built on one man, so...
No, that's right. You really do need to support a team around you to deploy it in a larger network. If you're running a small wireless ISP and you're just using it to do point-to-point tunnel or push some PPPoE around the place, you can probably have one person doing it. But if someone else has to come along and they're not familiar with it, they're not going to be fixing it anytime soon.
So when you're doing the PPPoE tunneling over that, are you using like one pool that's running on like the core of this tunnel? And then, because right now the dilemma I have is all of our towers have their own public pools, and I would like to consolidate those pools, because a lot of the towers I'm starting to have to push extra subnets out there because I've consumed them. And if you could just have a centralized pool, it would make it so much easier.
You can do that, and that's definitely something that we do. We'll usually run a VPLS tunnel back from each tower, and there'll be a bridge, obviously, on the tower that the customers who need PPP are going into, and we usually run bridge filters on there to restrict them to only be able to pass PPPoE sessions, and then you have your central pool and hand it out. So the advantage is it's easier to administer. You can have that single pool. The disadvantage is if you've got customer-to-customer traffic, it has to traverse all the way back to the concentrator to go to a customer that might be next door to them. That's a disadvantage.
Have you had any problems with switching loops in those situations?
No. I've seen people have problems with it, but Microtik have provisioned in their split horizon bridging, so you can quite easily solve that.
Cool. Man with the answer.
I got asked that one last week.
I'll probably have a look in the next couple of weeks at putting up some sort of basic MPLS tutorial. So anyone that's interested, give us a yell and let me know what you want to see.
I want to see it all, Andrew.
Yeah, I want to see it all too.
There's some really good examples on the Microtik wiki. some of them go a little bit too in-depth. Like, they're not what you'd use to kind of try and learn this, but there are good examples on there. They're not very well explained, but they're still good to have a look at.
That's a lot of the material on the wiki. It's here's how you do it, period.
But not how you would do it or why you would do it, just this is how you do it.
Yeah.
So, is there any other pieces of interest? Because I know you do more than just MPLS entry. There's other facets to you. So tell us something else.
I guess some of the more recent projects we've done for customers have just been, we've had customers that have wanted to do DR between sites, and we've put up networks with Microtik doing that. So 802.11n on public frequency, so 5 gigahertz with RB800s and that sort of thing, and just backhaul their data with that. That's always fun. And we've had some pretty good results. So getting 150 megabits full duplex UDP over about 6 kilometers using NV2. It's going quite well, so something different to play with, get up on a hill.
So it sounds like you've been using the kind of like the 800 series board where you put in the cards and you put it in an enclosure. Have you tried any of the, like the SXT stuff, or I mean kind of the, like the solid state, just this is your radio go sort of devices?
Yeah, I have. I help a couple of wireless ISPs down here in New Zealand, and I put up a few towers for them where we've had RB433 UAHs with the Ubiquiti 90-degree sectors hanging off them, and then SXTs going into those, and those have been really reliable, I have to say, even on seaside. Like, a lot of people have, worries about their weatherproofing and how they're going to handle salt and that, and we've had some up there for over a year and no problems so far.
Cool.
We haven't exactly gone up there and actually, we haven't gone up there and opened them and had a look, but I mean, they're still running, and they're still running reliably. The customers are happy.
That's kind of... Oh, go ahead, Andrew, I'm sorry.
So say, what sort of ubiquity experience do you have on a day-to-day basis to jump across to the other main camp that we discuss?
My ubiquity experience is pretty low. I guess we've got some of the UAP pros and that sort of thing, but we've kind of stayed away from it because we like all the routing functionality inside the Microtik. Yeah. One box to do everything kind of thing.
Fair enough. Yeah. I was going to say, on the one of my theories is that everything's moving to kind of the solid device where you buy a big plastic brick and it does whatever that function is. So do you think you feel like you guys will stick with like the 800s, the 433s, where you can customize, or do you think, given like the proper options, you guys would shift to kind of a solid device?
I think given the proper options, you would definitely shift. It's going to reduce the amount of research that guys have to put into it, and you're going to have a platform that's proven, and you can just deploy and know it's going to work. With the stuff that we've been deploying, there's a lot of trial and error to see what does and doesn't work.
Yeah. Definitely. And, I mean, if it's all packaged into one device, I guess they officially support that configuration. They can't say, oh, well, we don't really support that card.
That's right. I mean, we haven't had very good experience with Microtik radios, for example, like the R52HN and that sort of thing. We usually use DB2 radios or Ubiquiti radios. It might just be our scenario, but we've had to go through a lot of trial and error to come to this conclusion, and a lot of things not working to get there.
Mm. Or a lot of things working and then stop working. That's been my experience with the R52s.
Yes. The TX power and RX power just mysteriously half overnight kind of thing. Yeah.
Interesting.
Speaking of hardware support, I think we've done the MPLS to death now.
Yeah, we've beaten that.
The RB2011U, the new one they've released with wireless, the LCD display, and SFP, like the other version. I saw you had a couple of comments about the SFPs the other day, Andrew.
Yeah. I think I called you out.
The SFP port on them, it's got no DDMI, so you can't see any of the stats off the module. You can't see if it's receiving a signal. You can't see anything. And that's part of the problem with it. you know you've got a link there because the other end's telling you you've got a link, but you can't actually tell on the RV2011 whether you've actually got a link or not. And that's also, Microtech probably didn't think about it, that's introduced the problem where you can only use gigabit SFPs in it. If you try and use 100 megabit ones in it, it hasn't got DDMI, so it can't detect that it's a 100 megabit module and change the PHY speed to match it, which is why you'll see a lot of people complaining on the forums about the 100 meg modules not working.
Mm. Yeah, I haven't seen a lot of that. And also, I noticed that if you in software, disable the SFP, you know, turn it off, it's still actually pumping out light. Yeah. So when you're using those single mode optics, be sure not to stare into them, because you get a nice little retina tattoo. And so I emailed support asking them, hey, is this a bug or did you guys know this?
It's a feature.
Yeah, they said it's a limitation in this version of the hardware. They're putting out a new hardware revision of the board. They said it's going to have the DDMI, which is supposedly going to fix everything, I guess. I don't know that it's going to be the miracle cure, but it sounds like it's going to fix a lot. When that hardware revision is going to come out.
Call it the RV 2012.
Yeah, right. All I got to do is, no telling when, I mean, whenever they choose to release it, it will be here, but they said that it's going to happen, so I guess I will hope that it happens. But in the meantime, I guess, in theory, the price of a 2011 and SFP is less expensive or just as expensive as your standard 100 meg media converter, so just go ahead and buy two of them for either side of the link, I guess.
Yeah, that's right.
Go with it.
There's been a lot of interesting feedback on the LCD screen as well, so there's a quick demonstration of it in the newest newsletter that came out, just showing wireless traffic pumped over it, but the positioning is a little odd unless you're mounting it in the wall mount that they sell. Yeah. And
horizontally, yeah. That would, I mean, to me that kind of is the only way that makes sense, I guess, is if you mount it horizontally on the wall.
I get that it seems useful, like you can send a client over to have a look and say, what does it show on this screen? And if you tap here, it will show your Ethernet interfaces are up. So I guess for diagnosis, it's a handy gizmo to have, but it seems to me that's all it really is at the moment. It's just a little gizmo that's, ooh, my router's got a screen on it. So
yeah, and I wonder how customizable that's going to be. I mean, if you could script it in such a way that it would display messages, like specific messages, for the customer
to
look at. Yeah.
$50 for the first person to get Doom running on it?
I don't know, because you can overclock these things to 750 megahertz, so I'm pretty sure Doom would run on that, wouldn't it?
It would probably run on less.
And then a lot of people, too, were arguing about the micro USB port. I think Andrew Thrift, the Kiwi over there, had something to say about it as well.
I just think that whole platform looks like an afterthought. Someone's kind of come up with a box, a nice metal box, and they thought, hey, we'll add a screen on the top and throw in some USB, but they've never been designed with it in the first place. So it looks like that's why they had to go with the micro USB. Norman's commented that it was actually a feature. It was designed that way on purpose, but he wouldn't elaborate on why. So it'll be interesting to see what they come up with.
Yeah, the only way I could justify it was that if you do wall mount it in that cool little cute enclosure, it kind of precludes any kind of 3G modem being stuck in the bottom of that thing. So the only way you could actually plug a 3G modem would be to use a little dongle the way they have it designed. So I'm thinking they designed the 2011, then that frame, and then later thought, hey, we need to put a USB on this. What are we going to do? So I think maybe that's what
they could have done what they did on the 750s and just cut a hole in the side.
Right, that would have been better.
Yeah, I would have preferred that as well.
But they already had the box designed and stamped out, so they were like,
I've got to say, on the 750s, that, like, even though that it's a hole in the side, that works well for most of the dongles I've seen. You get the ones that have little 90-degree flex on the end. Stick one of those in and just fold it over, and there's nothing to bump easily or break. So it seems to work well in there, but if they're saying this one is a design feature, then maybe there's something else coming out we don't know about yet.
Some kind of USB device, you think?
A GPS module for their radios.
Yeah, GPS module.
For their indoor models?
3G, 3G device, maybe. Who knows?
I like their own 3G device, you think so?
I mean, you can do networking over USB, so maybe there's a stacking feature or something they're looking at.
I know, but the throughput's so low because it's only USB 2, right? I don't know. See, you got to say these things off-cast so I can think about stuff before we talk about it. That's ridiculous. That's an interesting idea, though. I didn't think about them trying to design an additional device for it. Although it could be kind of what the 750G was, like an introduction, let's see how it works, and then once we get it refined, we'll ditch that model 6 months later and put out the 750GL. So maybe they're just trying out a couple features on this and let it run for a year, then ditch it and go the direction they really...
I don't know. I was in love with the G when they ditched it. I was let down.
That 600 megahertz CPU was really nice in that small form factor, especially for that price. I think... 750G, for that price, I think they might have underpriced it a little bit. I think maybe that's what happened to that. I think they just made it too cheap and the margins weren't high enough, so they had to kill it. Looking at kind of the same sort of CPU and the models they have now, like in the price difference, I think maybe that's just what happened. But I don't know, that's all speculation.
One thing with Microtech is that they seem to make a model to fit every person's requirement. Like, how many different 711 models are there? Why couldn't they have just made one? Is it to meet a price point? Surely the tooling, the retooling to make all these different products is more costly than if they just made one. I don't know.
I don't know.
Looking at the revisions they've gone through, it's essentially like they've created the base model, then they've gone through and gone, We could put USB in this, we could put PoE ports, we could upgrade the wireless. Like we've gone, 750 to 751 to 750GL.
So what you're saying is they're adopting the iPhone model then, is what you're saying?
Yeah, you build a better one and people will buy that to replace their existing one. I mean,
but they keep making the old one too.
Maybe it works for them, so... But yeah, you would think that it would be cheaper and more cost effective to come out with a model that has the best of all the features and then maybe offer a reduced one for those who didn't want it. But like if I'm going to buy a 5-port, one of those little Soho ones, I'm not even going to bother buying a 100 meg one nowadays. I'll buy a gigabit one and I'll get the fastest CPU that's in it because in reality, I'm paying around $100. Like compared to other networking equipment that we pay for, it's a drop in the bucket.
Yeah, and you got to think with the volume increase on the gigabit model, the margins, on their components would shrink. The price is going to be a lot lower. So if the price dropped $10 on the gigabit version, I mean, it would be a no brainer just to pay an extra $10 and go ahead and have. I mean, everybody would.
Exactly.
Nobody would complain about it at that point. I don't know. So what do you think about the they finally dropped the 2011 model, which is nice because you can the 2011 LRM, it's rack mount. It's got a little rack mount. Okay, so I think it's super cute. The one thing I think that's obviously missing that everybody will agree is they didn't put the SFP port on it.
Yeah, that'll be the next release. That'll be the RMS or something.
Maybe the mini USB inside will snake over to SFP ports. It'll be like a little SFP module.
They need to hire someone to improve their nomenclature.
So. The lettering stuff, is that getting confusing?
Yeah, it is. It's like you got to have a chart, a flow chart, just to be able to tell what the thing does. It's like, okay, I need that one.
I think there is one of those somewhere that lists what the things are. Like U means it has USB, and 2HN means it has built-in two channel and wireless. And
I think H means that it's high power. I've seen the chart when
is that one of the MUMs, wasn't it? Well, yeah, one of the little pamphlets they hand out or something?
Yeah.
RB951 versus RB750. The series number is the first one, so the 9 or the 7 or whatever, or the 4 is the series. The second number is the number of Ethernet ports on it. Third number is the number of wireless ports. And I'd say based on like the RB433s and things like that, it should be the number of built-in, but then you look at like the RB800, which has ports on it, and the naming doesn't match up there. So
should be the RB834 by your model numbers.
Yeah. it should be an RB834, but for the 700 series and the 400 series, it matches up, and now the 900 series, it matches. Just the 800. Something happened there.
Maybe they thought of that later. They just kind of been making them. And,
One thing I noticed while we're talking about these two specific model numbers, the new 2011 with the million letters after it, the LCD and that thing, versus the rack mount version is the one with the LCD version has 128 megs of RAM and a level 5 license, whereas the rack mount has 64 megs of RAM and a level 4. Do you think that extra 64 megs of RAM is just to control the LCD? And I mean, why did they bump up to a level 5? I guess they expect people to do like
scripting or something on it?
Aggregation on this thing or something? I don't know.
I don't know. Has anyone here ever actually filled the RAM on one of those large devices? Like the 32 meg ones? Yeah, maybe if you try and do BGP on them, you're going to wait for 10 minutes while it collects the full tables and then fills up the RAM. But on other ones, there's not even the CPU to reasonably quickly handle a full table, and the RAM never gets filled anyway.
I was thinking maybe that's a tie-in to that new feature for the USB. I don't know.
I had I was running the Dude 3.6 package on a 2011, or not a 2011, but I think it was a 1000, the little bitty guy that was just a board, and it would chew up the memory on it real quick because there was a problem there.
Yeah, I was going to say, people still run the Dude on router boards, though.
That's a terrible idea. They shouldn't put it there.
I gave up on running it on router OS after like the third time that we tried to do a backup of it, and it just dropped the entire config. So.
There's a dog there on a chain snarling. You tell him, he'll probably bite you if you go over there. Put a fence around the dog. Just remove the dog.
So there's a rumor floating around I've seen that there's a new version of the Dude on the horizon.
I'd say it's a bit more than a rumor. It was Normus on the forums that actually posted there was a new one coming. He said they're looking at releasing something in Q3, so they've got another month to do so. But knowing their general timelines, I mean, it could be closer to end of year. But I'm excited about that. There's a lot of features they could potentially be adding in, not least of which is IPv6 support, which is missing from there at the moment.
Would that be your number one feature you were looking for?
It's not a critical feature for us just yet, but I'd say overall it's the one that makes the most sense to add in.
What's your number one feature? I don't care about everybody else. What makes sense? What do you want?
I don't know. There's a lot of different things. Having a better way to record and report outages and things like that. The graphing built into the Dude at the moment.
I would like more granular graphing.
Yeah. Mm. And being able to actually go back to see that, rather than them just aggregating it all together after a period of time. So rather than these little spiky lines, you end up with just this big curve. Yeah. And that's all in the one graph. There's no way to actually have a look at a specific segment.
I would like for it to just not forget my interface graphs. It just, I don't know, it's just like that OID just vanishes. And I recreate it manually, and it vanishes again.
I know. For me too, on my Microtix, or like in my Cacti install, I've got a template that just automatically pulls memory, CPU, storage, all of my queues, all of my interfaces, ARP tables, everything. If the dude could just right-click and start automatically graphing all that stuff, that would be magical.
That would be magical.
My number one, by the way, is automated backups for all the devices in the nude. If you could just set a schedule that would say, backup everything nightly, boom, and then have it save into like a repository that can do like differentials on your backups.
Even if it called your auto
backup.
Do what, dude?
I was going to say a rancid style backup. So the same rancid being the Cisco config backup open source option, which we actually have doing most of our MikroTik devices at the moment. So I guess that's why that's not high on my list there. But yes, backups integrated with the Dude would be excellent.
There we go. Thrift, what do you got?
They've got now got a traffic generator in the MikroTik. I'd like to see some sort of IP SLA functionality in there, where you can have a bunch of devices and the Dude can generate some traffic on one, receive it on the other, and you can kind of see if it meets the SLAs you've got with your customers, and if not, then send a notification.
That would be
some fake RTP or SIP and make sure it arrives in time, that sort of thing.
That would be cool. I still have, if I could, my room's a mess, but if I could show you, I have a huge stack of like old 800 series Ciscos and 1700 series that just run IP SLA that we put on either end of nodes. So IP SLA... for you guys probably aren't familiar with, like in the Cisco world and stuff, it's a protocol you can run on your Cisco routers, and it'll generate traffic in between, and it'll actually give you stats like jitter, delay, loss. It'll pull web statistics, DNS query time. It can do all that stuff, sense it across a link, and then make it available via SNMP, and you can graph that stuff. So if you could just have the MikroTik automatically do that, that would be amazing.
It would be good. That would be one of the killer features for us. I mean, we're still selling quite a lot of Cisco 800 series for exactly the same reason, and two reasons, the IP SLA and the fact that they've got DSL interfaces built in. But, I mean, if they had an SLA feature in MikroTik, that would be awesome.
That would be. That would be super cool. We would buy a ton of the lowest models we could get and throw them everywhere just for that exact reason. Yeah, that would be pretty awesome. That's cool. So speaking of the Dude, a new version of the Dude, there was the Ubiquiti. What's the Air Control? Is that what it's called? JJ, is that Air Control? Is that the Ubiquiti monitor thing? Yeah, they just came out with a new beta.
They've got a new version of it that I'm not sure what's going on with it right now. So.
I know the video looks cute. I saw a video of it that got disseminated somewhere on the web, and it looked
on their website. I'm pretty sure it's on just the forum there. I think you can go to the regular Air Control and see their video on the new Air Control. And right now, that video is the best thing that I've seen as far as that software goes.
Okay. From the way JJ's talking, I'm assuming he hasn't had much exposure to it yet, or else he would talk more about it. But it looked cool. Some of the features looked neat. A lot of the right-click and do this, do that looked the same, so you could right-click, update stuff. One thing I did notice, too, was that you could right-click on a node and say, generate like dummy devices. So you could generate like 40 type of XYZ device. That was kind of neat. And all the cute little lines that moved and stuff like that. So it looks really pretty.
As with all the Ubiquiti stuff, it looks like they've put a lot of polish into the interface itself. So
yeah.
Making it a nice, easy to navigate system from the start. It looks like it will be a good upgrade to the current options. So.
Yeah, and using the old version.
I've had good luck with the old version, but if you get on over about 200 devices on it, since it's SSHing into every device every few seconds, it generates a lot of chatter, and the computer that you have it on starts kind of crapping on itself. So I usually bring up different VMs and run 200 devices on each one and just say, okay, this is tower this, tower that, you know.
Interesting. Okay.
But this new version is a lot lighter. It's a very small package. I've not had as much FaceTime with it as I would like, but I've had quite a bit of time with it, but I honestly don't know. I've not read the beta, I've not read the beta stuff as far as what people, you can go sign up for the beta. Anybody can, I think, that wants to sign up for it, but I don't think they like people talking intimately about the beta products. So.
Gotcha. So moving back to the hardware thing. Do what?
It's a beta. What do you expect?
Yeah, exactly. It's a beta. But the other air control. The other air control never actually came out. Did it? Did the other air control version ever make it out of beta? I don't think it did.
No, they deprecated it. And as far as I can tell, the programmer that was responsible for that package is no longer with the company. So, Thomas. It's kind of neat the way they do stuff. They're like, okay, here's Thomas. This is his job. And then they just feed him to the wolves on the forum. And I really like that about Ubiquity. It's like this is these guys' project, and they're working on it, and help them make it better.
So, nice.
Yeah.
Nice. Fair enough.
Better them than me.
Yeah.
So moving back to the hardware side really quick. Microtik also released the RB44GE, which is a 4-port gigabit copper PCIe Express card, a Theros chipset, so it's going to be supported in Router OS. A lot of people were saying that, or at least Microtik said that they were kind of moving away from it. What do you guys think? Moving away from x86, and now
yeah, I've heard them say that a couple of times. So maybe that means that they're going to make a machine that has PCIe slots in it, like a router board.
Well, I mean, that would mean they would have to, well, not necessarily switch back to x86 architecture. What if the Tilera supports PCI Express?
It does. If you look at the bus information on the CPU, it does.
Yeah, it's definitely listed there. Although an x86 device would be welcome. I mean, I'm assuming there's not being a router code programmer myself. I'm assuming it's easier to work with x86, given that's what the Linux kernel is primarily built to support. So
I would think you have a lot more headroom in there too. Like every megabit doesn't really matter as much in the x86 platform. Plus,
you build things bigger and bigger.
Yeah, it's the American way. I really want to see them come out like with a standardized mega router. So if they did x86, that would be great. Just come out with one big mega x86. And then, because every vendor right now has their own version of their little x86 box, and so not everything exactly works right. Drivers are kind of weird in some of the versions on some people's hardware, and then certain new upgrades kind of tweak out their hardware. And so, some people on their x86 board, if you rebooted it, occasionally the Ethernet interfaces would renumber themselves, just randomly. So I think if they came out with one standardized that always worked, it would really drop the prices. We wouldn't have any of these issues anymore.
That renumbering happens on Microtik's own hardware, so.
Yeah. I saw it on notoriously on a certain vendor's like third-party x86 device. Like every single time on this huge chunk of code train, it would happen. That's kind of scary. Just a little.
That happened when I went from like 5. I don't know. It was like 5.10 to 5.15 on the 2011s.
Yeah. There was definitely some renumbering that was going on. I had a couple of requests via my site from people that were saying, yeah, certain devices, as they were upgrading them, all the ports would get relabeled, and they wanted to have a script to relabel them from 1 through to 13 or whatever. This was the RB1100, label them back in order of MAC address again. So there was some interesting stuff. I'm not sure if it was a firmware change that their one was, or whether it was a software upgrade.
Interesting. So I wonder if you upgrade the software and then does it happen, or do you have to upgrade the software, then upgrade the router board firmware for it to happen?
From what I've seen on the 1100s, all you need to be doing is running 5.16 or newer, and every time you reboot it, ports 11 and 12 will renumber.
Okay.
Really?
Glad I'm sticking with 5.14 for now.
The thing is, we always use ports 11 and 12 and bond them together, so it was particularly frustrating.
Gotcha. So it's like a hardware coin flip. I like it.
I do have a question I'd like to address that came in on my personal blog. The guy asked about ice bridges on towers, and you guys being in more, I would assume, tropical climates, it's probably not something you guys have to worry about too much, but could be wrong. But just to address his question, any time that I'm deploying anything about 2,800 feet or higher in elevation, it's mandatory. Ice bridges, definitely.
JJ, you are the most random person ever.
I am. I've sat here and wrote like half of a Python program while you guys have been talking.
Oh, because we're not important enough to listen to.
No. I can't get my mind off of it. So
I'll add your ice bridges in, crazy person. Alright. So so we were talking about the x86 new PCI Express interface. Anybody closing remarks on that one?
I think it's good. I mean, now whenever you email MicroTik support with any x86 interface problems, they'll just tell you to go and buy their $80 card and that it will fix everything.
Yeah, I think the price is brilliant. One thing I am kind of disappointed about is that it's PCI Express, and like all of the old hardware that I can get super cheap is all like PCI extended, so it doesn't take the Express interface. So they're making me be not nearly as cheap, which is unfortunate.
Is there any additional offloading or anything like that done on it? Like, I didn't see any real killer features. It seemed to just be a cheap gigabit card with a bridge between the ports. Like, I don't know what
it appears to have TOE on the chipset. Whether MicroTik are going to use that's in the question.
Would be nice. I guess if they're building their own drivers for it, they should.
Yeah, with them building their own drivers, my hope was that it would show you the extended Ethernet statistics, so how many packets of 15.19, 15.10, kind of that sort of thing.
Same way they do on the others.
Yeah, like on their PPC platforms, they show you that, whereas on x86, nothing will.
Hmm. All right, so I know Andrew Cox, are you going to be able to stay or do you have to jet?
I've got to head off now, so...
All right, so any closing remarks for you, Mr. Cox?
Skyscrapers don't scrape sky.
Skyscrapers don't scrape.
And steamrollers do not roll steam. Think about that.
Classic words of wisdom from Andrew. Well, thanks, Andrew, for sticking around with us. Apparently, we've Thrift and JJ and I have to talk about ice bridges for a minute.
Okay, I'll leave this all to it.
All right, JJ, tell us about these ice bridges.
They're not platforms to walk on, first of all.
Did you find that out?
First person. So put your antennas under them, not on top of them.
So basically a break for, like, falling ice, right?
Correct. Like, in your more...
cold environments?
Yeah, your frigid environments. Like, on the mountains that we deploy on, some of them are like, 6,000, 7,000 feet. So, in the wintertime, or even in the spring and the fall... You'll have like ice chunks the size of cars that form up in these towers, and when it thaws, it doesn't just melt off. It falls out in humongous chunks, so your antennas and your equipment will just be destroyed by them. And I had a guy ask, what do you recommend on as far as ice bridges go? And I said, well, anytime you're above 2,800 feet. Definitely run ice bridges. Anything below 2,800 feet, in my opinion. It's your discretion, but I don't see you spending or having that expense, that extra expense, because all that material is super expensive. Because you gotta build it so that, you know, 1,000-pound chunks of ice get dissipated when it hits it. So
crazy. And I've seen pictures that you've personally sent me of your equipment having a front end meeting with a chunk of ice, right?
Yes. I've got dishes behind the building that just have been caved in with chunks of ice. Some of the 2-meter dishes that we've got that used to be television hardware. I've got one of those. It was an Andrews 2-meter dish, and it just got pulverized by ice 2 years ago. So, 2,800 feet and up, ice bridges, definitely. So that was the only question I had come in this week.
Cool, man.
I didn't mean to hijack the thread a minute ago, but I got like 2 minutes. I'm on a timer now.
It's classic JJ, man. It's just your brain is just always working. It's like the hamster in there is on crack. He's just going. going. All right, JJ.
And the Beagle Bone. Everybody needs to go out and buy one. They're great.
Hang on. So what we normally do right here at the end is we kind of say, hey, do you have anything you've done this week, anything interesting that's come up? So Andrew Thrift, I'll open it up for as far back as you want to go. Tell us anything interesting you've done. It doesn't necessarily have to be exactly IT related. Just anything you've done lately.
Oh, I guess what, personally, or what to do with?
Anything, man. I talked about how I made a rubber band gun last week, I think. So it could be anything.
Yeah, I can't really think of anything in particular I'd like to share with the audience, but I did a bit of cutting.
You're a public figure now. Your people want to know what you're thinking, what you're doing.
I do a bit of cutting in my spare time, so I've just been kind of getting back into that, and I've got a 2-year-old daughter, so I kind of haven't had the time for the last few years. Yeah, actually got around to getting my cart ready to go, so hopefully get out this summer. A bit of fun with that.
Man, that's awesome, dude. So it's
still winter over here in New Zealand.
That's what I was gonna say. I think isn't it? What's winter for you guys? How cold is winter really?
It's colder than Australia, but it's still pretty warm. I mean, it might get down to in the day, it might get up to say 16 degrees. At night, might get down to maybe -1°C. In the summer, I guess gets up to 30 sometimes. So it's not that cold really.
60 degrees? No, that's not bad at all.
No, not at all.
You got to convert it to American. Otherwise, I don't know what you're talking about.
Just add 32.
That's not how it works. That's cool, man. So, JJ, what have you been up to, dude? You mentioned the Beagle Bone.
Yeah, you mentioned it on the last cast, and then you had posted some stuff on Facebook about it. And I've been using the Arduino pretty intimately for the last year or so. And Greg turned me on to these BeagleBones, and they're essentially an embedded Linux platform that's got a ton of digital GPIOs and like 7 analog to digitals, and it's got I2C and 4 UARTs. I mean, it's just like awesome in the palm of your hand for someone that's into micros. And so I spent the entire last week getting temperature sensors going and monkeying around with the I2C bus and writing a little program that posts this up on the web, and I can turn relays or LEDs on and off from the web interface now. So I've had a real good time with it last week. So
it's, have you slept much since you got your BeagleBone?
No. actually, I ordered 3 of them initially, one for myself and 2 of my coworkers that are into this stuff as well. And we all had a bet on who was going to fry theirs first. And I didn't win it. So Sam actually won it. He plugged a PoE into it and fried the MagJack. So oops. Well, technically, I plugged it in, but he handed me the wire and said, plug this in.
Yeah, he told you to.
Yeah.
That's like suicide by cop. That's horrible, man. I can't believe he'd do that to you.
Well, the the BeagleBoard still works, and they do this creative thing with the USB port where they, when you unmount the SD card, it creates a network widget that runs over USB, so they create like a virtual network interface on your Windows install, so you can actually, you know, get to it over IP through the USB port, so you can still SSH into the guy, or since it is plugged into USB, you can, you know, run it as a COM port and use Hyperterm if you're old. So
that's cool. So for some of the people that don't know yet, it is an embedded product that runs full Linux distro. So I guess the new hotness is the Raspberry Pi. That's what everybody's talking about, the Raspberry Pi. But this, I know, I've been reading about how many driver issues people are having with the Raspberries right now, not only with USB, but the network interface on there. Well, the network interface is itself to the hardware through the USB interface. So the USB is the core of the problem there. And BeagleBone's been out longer. It's been, this is version 6 of it. So there's a lot more code for it already out there. I think it's the more mature, stable product at this point.
The default distro that comes on it is Angstrom, and some people have used it on embedded devices all the way down to like a 6 megabyte build, like super stripped down, just to fit on a flash. I've not looked. It comes with a 4 gig card when you order it. Everybody sell them for usually about 90 US dollars. I was able to pick up a couple for right at 70 US dollars, so which was awesome. So, and I went ahead and ordered a few more because I actually sold some vaporware that I got to build this week. So,
is that right? you are a consultant in the making. I'm just saying.
Yeah. So, I made most of it today. It's we're doing a diversion UPS that does temperature and voltage monitoring. So
diversion, like you say, look over here. Well, it doesn't actually.
I just use like a relay and divert the load away from the battery as long as it takes for the battery to float back down to 12 volts. So
interesting.
So I just open it and say, when it gets down to 12 volts, connect the charger, okay?
So. Gotcha. Well, that's pretty straightforward.
Yeah, it's super simple. So. And then it you can also do like huge loads that way. You know, if you need to charge, you know, a 40 amp circuit, no problem. So just get a big honking relay. So
that's cool. All right, so let's see. What did I do this week? I got a stomach virus, so I was pretty much out of commission again. Man, I don't know what it is, but this is the summer. I'm not supposed to be getting sick repeatedly. You know, I keep getting beat down, and my kids are testing me. Plus, school just started, so the kids are back in school, so now I'm just going to get sick again. I don't know. It's a vicious cycle.
Bring home all the good stuff for you.
You know, my immune system's going to be able to kill a water buffalo after this summer, I think, or after this winter gets here. I don't know. All I did was just work and do that, I guess. Nothing interesting. My brain's still not really functioning yet, so this is about all I could handle. But I guess this is us wrapping it up. We've jabbered on long enough. I know we have a tendency, especially when JJ and I get together, we just kind of talk and talk, and it happens pretty much every week. Andrew, thank you so much for popping in. I'm hoping we can get you back in here for more color commentary, more expert advice, and some hair tips, possibly where to pick up Jeff.
It was definitely nice meeting you tonight.
Yeah, it's good meeting you guys as well.
All right. Well, you guys have a good night, and everybody, thanks for watching. Keep sending us questions, comments. We love feedback. We obviously do this, one, to hear our own voices, but two, to know that you like to hear our voices. So let us know. So thanks, everybody, and good night.